Chapter 4. In many ways, the cleansing of Laeron represented the epitome of Fulgrim's quest for perfection. The battles waged on the ocean planet were savage and merciless, each victory won only after fighting that was as bloody as any in the Legion's history, but won with a speed of war that bordered on the miraculous. The extermination of the Lair and the bringing to its knees of their entire world was being bought with the dead of the Emperor's children. Each atoll that was captured was swiftly transformed into a base of operations to be held by the Archite Palatines while the Space Marines prosecuted their Primarch's relentless campaign. Though the Lair were a technologically advanced species, they had never fought a foe as dedicated to their utter destruction as Fulgrim's Legion. Such was the Primarch's exquisite planning and prescient thoroughness that nothing the Lair could do was enough to halt or even delay their inevitable fate. Living and dead specimens of Lair warriors were brought aboard the Pride of the Emperor for study under strict quarantine protocols, and were dissected by Legion apothecaries to glean as much information about the foe as was possible. Specimens varied from the warrior breed that had defended Atoll 19 to avian creatures with barbed wings and poisonous bites, and aquatic monsters with genetically modified lungs and harpoon-like barbs instead of tails. To see such varieties in one species was fascinating, and more were brought on board for study. With each victory, the renown earned by the Legion's captains and warriors grew, and Fulgrim commissioned hundreds of new works of art in their honour. The vessels of the fleet soon resembled immense galleries, with exquisite paintings hanging on their walls and sculpted marble sitting on pedestals of gleaming onyx. Libraries worth of poetry and entire symphonies were written, and it was even whispered that Bekwakinska had begun a new opera to commemorate the imminent victory. First Captain Julius Caseron, denied a place in the initial assaults of Atoll 19, was granted the honour of leading the front-line troops under the overall command of Lord Commander Vespasian. Though Eidolon held seniority of rank, he had led the forces that had rendered 28-2 compliant, and thus the honour fell to Vespasian. The war for Laeron was fought across many varied battlefields, the warriors of the Emperor's children fighting on floating atolls and through the ruins of ancient structures that reared from the oceans, while foaming breakers crashed against walls that had once stood thousands of metres in the air. Underwater cities were discovered within days of the campaign's opening, and detachments of Astartes took the fight to the abyssal darkness of undersea trenches, smashing into structures that had never known the touch of sunlight in specially modified boarding torpedoes fired from cruisers hovering above the sea. Solomon Demeter led the second against the first of these cities, subjugating it within 6 hours, his plan of attack garnering praise from the Primarch. Marius Verusian fought numerous actions against Lair orbitals that had previously escaped detection, fighting boarding actions on alien vessels controlled by pilots telepathically linked to their ships in a loathsome, parasitic manner. Julius Caseron coordinated the attacks on the Lair atolls, discerning a pattern in their movements that had hitherto been perceived as random. At first, the atolls had been thought of as independent entities that forged their own destinies through the skies of the planet. But as he analysed the patterns, Julius had seen that each travelled within the orbit of one particular atoll. It was neither the biggest nor most impressive of the atolls that had been identified, but the more the pattern was studied, the more obvious its importance became. Strategic advisers theorised that it was perhaps a seat of what passed for government on Laeron, but when the pattern was revealed to the Primarch, he immediately saw its true purpose. It was not a place of governance, it was a place of worship. Icy fluorescent lights bathed the apothecarium of the Pride of the Emperor in a bright glare that reflected dazzlingly from glass cabinets and gleaming steel bowls containing surgical instruments or bloody organs. Apothecary Fabius directed his menials as they wheeled a heavy gurney bearing the corpse of a Lair warrior from the chill of the temperature-controlled mortuary cabinets. Fabius kept his long white hair, the mirror of the Primarch's, tied in a severe scalp lock, accentuating the sharpness of his features and the coldness of his dark eyes. His movements were curt, their exactness reflecting his intensity and the precision of his methodology. His armour stood upon a rack in his arming chamber, and thus he was dressed in his red surgical robes and a heavy rubberized apron smeared with dark alien blood. Wisps of cold air rose from the body, and he nodded in satisfaction as the menials halted the gurney next to the stone autopsy slab upon which lay another Lair warrior, fresh from the battlefield. This specimen had been killed by a shot to the head, and so the majority of its body was largely undamaged, at least from the fighting. Its flesh was still warm to the touch, and it stank with the oily stench of its secretions. Reams of data scrolled on hololithic panes suspended on thin cables from the ceiling, projecting ghostly, crawling images around the bare, antiseptic walls. Fabius had been working on this warm body for the last few hours, and the fruits of his labours had been singular. He had removed the alien's innards, its organs displayed like trophies on silver trays that surrounded the mortuary slab. The suspicion that had been forming in his mind since the assault on Atoll 19 had been confirmed, and, armed with this information, he had sent word to Lord Fulgrim of his findings. The Primarch stood at the entrance to the Apothecarian, the halberd-armed Phoenix Guard standing a respectful distance behind the Lord of the Emperor's Children. Though the white-tiled Apothecarian was spacious and high-ceilinged, it felt cramped with the Primarch here. Such was his presence. Fulgrim had come directly from the fighting, still clad in his purple battle-plate, the blood still singing in his veins from the fierce melee. The war was entering its third week, and there had been no let-up in the fighting, each battle pushing the Lair from their various atolls towards the one the Primarch had identified as a place of worship. "This had better be good, Apothecary," said Fulgrim. "I have a world to win." Fabius nodded and leaned over the cooled corpse, a scalpel blade sliding from his Narthesium gauntlet and slicing through the stitching that held the incisions on its chest closed. He pulled the thick flaps of skin and muscle back to reveal its interior, affixing clamps to hold them open. Fabius smiled as he saw the insides of the Lair warrior, again admiring the perfect arrangement of organs that had made it such a fearsome killing machine. "It is, my lord," promised Fabius. "I've never imagined anything like it, and nor, I suspect, has anyone else for that matter, save the more extreme genetic theorists of Terra." "Anything like what?" demanded Fulgrim. "Do not try my patience with riddles, Apothecary." "It's fascinating, my lord, quite fascinating," said Fabius, standing between the two Lair corpses. "I have performed genetic analyses of both these specimens and have found much that may be of interest."
"All that interests me about these creatures is how they die," said Fulgrim, and Fabius knew that he had better reach his point quickly. The pressures of leading such an intensive campaign, personally, were demanding, even for a Primarch.
"Indeed, my lord, indeed," said Fabius. "But I believe you may be interested in how these specimens lived. From the researches I have undertaken, it appears that the Lair are not so dissimilar to us in their approaches to perfection."
Fabius indicated the opened chest cavities of the Lair warriors and said,
"Take these two specimens. They are genetically identical in the sense that they are from the same gene strand, but their internal workings have been modified."
"Modified?" asked Fulgrim. "For what purpose?"
"To better adapt them for the role they were to fulfill in Lair society, I should imagine," replied Fabius. "They are quite marvellous specimens, genetically and chemically altered from birth to perfectly fulfil a predetermined role. This one, for example, is clearly a warrior. Its central nervous system designed to operate at a much higher level of functionality than the envoys we captured at the outset of the war. And do you see these glands here? Fulgrim leaned close to the corpse, his nose wrinkling in disgust at the alien stench of it.
What do they do?
These are designed to release a compound onto the lair's carapace, which forms a toughened scab over areas damaged in combat. In effect, these organs are a biological self-repairing function that can patch up damage within moments of it occurring. We are lucky that Captain Demeter was able to kill it so cleanly with a headshot.
Do all the lair have these organs? Asked Fulgrim. Fabius shook his head, indicating the scrolling data on the hololithic plates. Images of dissected lair flashed up, and flickering projections of various alien organs rotated in the air above the corpses.
No, they do not, explained Fabius, and that is what makes them so fascinating. Each lair is altered from birth to perfectly achieve the purpose for which it is designed, be it a warrior, a scout, a diplomat, or even an artist. Some of the earliest envoys we apprehended had enlarged ocular cavities to better capture light. Others had enhanced speech centres of the brain, while yet others had been designed for strength and endurance, perhaps to better function as labourers. Fulgrim watched the data on the plates, absorbing the information at a speed beyond that of any mortal man.
They move towards their own perfection.
Indeed, my lord, said Fabius. To the lair, altering their physical makeup is simply the first step on the road to perfection.
You believe the lair to be perfect, Fabius? Asked Fulgrim, a note of warning in his voice. Be careful what you say. To compare these Xeno creatures to the work of the Emperor would be unwise.
No, no, said Fabius hurriedly. What the Emperor has made of us is incredible, but what if it was but the first step on a longer road? We are the Emperor's children, and like children we must learn to walk on our own and take our own steps forward. What if we were to look upon our flesh and find new ways to improve upon it and bring it closer to perfection?
Improve upon it, said Fulgrim, towering over Fabius. I could have you killed for saying such things, apothecary.
My lord, said Fabius quickly, our purpose for living is to find perfection in all things, and that means we must put aside any notions of squeamishness or reverence that limit us in finding it.
What the Emperor crafted in us is perfect, stated Fulgrim.
Is it? Really? Asked Fabius, amazed at his own hubris in questioning the miraculous work that had gone into his own enhancement. Our beloved legion was almost destroyed at its very birth, remember? An accident destroyed nearly all the gene seed that went into our creation, but what if it was imperfection rather than an accident that brought about such a terrible thing?
I remember my own history, snapped Fulgrim. By the time my father first brought me to Terra, barely 200 warriors were all the legion could muster.
And do you remember what the Emperor told you when you learned of the accident?
I do, apothecary, said Fulgrim. My father said that it was best to have failure happen early in life, for it would awake the phoenix bird within me, so that I would rise from the ashes. Fulgrim stared at him, and he felt the power and anger in his lord's eyes, as he remembered the anguish of those long-ago days, knowing that he played a dangerous game. He may very well have signed his death warrant by speaking so frankly, but the possibilities that might be opened up were worth any risk. To attempt to unlock the secrets of the Emperor's work in creating the Astartes would be the greatest undertaking of his life. If such a thing was not worth a little risk, then what was? Fulgrim turned to the warriors of the Phoenix Guard and said, "Leave us. Wait outside for me, and do not return until I summon you." Even though their master was aboard his flagship, Fabius could see that the Primarch's bodyguards were uneasy about leaving their charge without their protection, but they nodded and made their way from the Apothecarian. When they had gone, and the door had shut behind them, Fulgrim turned to Fabius. The Primarch's eyes were thoughtful, and he glanced between the corpses and Fabius, though what thoughts filled his head were as alien to Fabius as those of the lair.
"You believe you can enhance the gene seed of the Astartes?" asked Fulgrim.
"I do not know for certain," said Fabius, struggling to contain his elation, "but I believe we have to at least try. It may be that it will prove to be fruitless, but if it is not..."
"We would move closer to perfection," said Fulgrim.
"And only by imperfection can we fail the Emperor," said Fabius.
Fulgrim nodded and said, "You may proceed, Apothecary. Do what must be done."
The Brotherhood of the Phoenix met by firelight in the Heliopolis, arriving in ones and twos as they passed through the great bronze portal, and took their seats around a wide, circular table placed at the centre of the dark floor. Reflected light from the ceiling bathed the table in light, and crackling orange flames burned in a brazier set into the surface of the table's centre. The high-backed chairs of black wood were equally spaced around the table, half of them occupied by cloaked warriors of the Emperor's children. Their armour shone, but each plate was battered and had clearly seen better days. Solomon Demeter watched Julius Caesaron and Marius Verosian pass the Phoenix Gate, and the remainder of the Legion's captains that were not currently in battle filed in after them. Solomon could feel their weariness and nodded to them as they sat to either side of him, grateful to see that his friends had returned safely from yet another grueling tour of duty on the planet below. The cleansing of Laren had been tough on them all. Fully three-quarters of the Legion's strength was in the field at any one time, and there was little chance for respite in such a demanding war. No sooner had each company's warriors returned to the fleet for resupply than they were sent into battle once more. Lord Fulgrim's plan was audacious and brilliant, but left little room for rest and recuperation. Even the normally indefatigable Marius looked exhausted.
"How many?" asked Solomon, already fearing the answer.
11 dead," said Marius, "though I fear another may die before the day is out."
7, sighed Julius. "What about you?"
8, said Solomon. "By the fire, this is brutal, and the others will have suffered a similar fate."
"If not worse," said Julius. "Our companies are the best."
Solomon nodded, knowing that Julius was not boasting, for such a thing was unknown to him, but simply stating a fact.
"New blood, too," he said, seeing two faces around the table that were new to the Brotherhood of the Phoenix. They bore the rank insignia of captain on their shoulder guards, the paint probably not even dry yet.
"Casualties are not confined to the rank-and-file warriors of the Legion," said Marius.
"Good leaders must necessarily put themselves in harm's way to inspire the men they lead." "You don't need to quote the book to me, Marius," said Solomon. "I was there when they wrote that part. I practically invented going up the centre."
"Did you also invent the concept of being the luckiest bastard alive?" cut in Julius.
"I've lost count of the number of times you ought to have been killed."
Solomon smiled, pleased to see that the war on Laren had not crushed everyone's spirits.
"Ah, Julius, the gods of battle love me, and they wouldn't see me dead on this piss-poor excuse for a planet."
"Don't say such things," cautioned Marius.
"What things?"
"Talking of gods and the like," said the captain of the third. "It is not seemly."
"Oh, don't get upset, Marius," smiled Solomon, clapping a hand on his friend's shoulder guard. "There's only one god of battle around this table, and I'm sitting next to him."
Marius shrugged off his hand and said, "Don't mock me, Solomon. I'm serious."
"Don't I know it?" said Solomon, a hurt look on his face. You need to lighten up a little, my friend. We can't go around with grim faces all the time, can we?
War is a grim business, Solomon, said Marius. Good men die, and we are responsible for bringing them back alive. Each death lessens us, and you would make jokes about it?
I don't think that's what Solomon meant, began Julius, but Marius cut him off.
Don't defend him, Julius. He knows what he said, and I am heartsick of hearing him run his mouth while brave warriors are dying.
Solomon was stung by Marius's words, and he felt his collar rising at the insult in his friend's words. He leaned close to Marius and said,
I would never dream of making light of the fact that men are dying, but I know that a great many more would not come back alive if not for me. We all deal with war in different ways, and if my way offends you, then I am sorry. But I am who I am, and I will change for no man.
Solomon stared at Marius, practically daring him to prolong the unexpected argument. But his fellow captain shook his head and said,
I am sorry, my friend. All this fighting has left me bellicose, and I seek to find cause to vent my anger.
It's fine, said Solomon, his anger draining away in an instant. You're so by the book that I can't help needling you from time to time, even when I know I shouldn't. I'm sorry.
Marius offered his hand, which Solomon took, and said, War makes fools of us all, when never more are we required to maintain our standards.
Solomon nodded and said,
You're right, but I don't know any other way to be. I let Julius take care of the culture side of things. Speaking of which, how is that little stable of remembrances you've been cultivating? Any new busts or portraits of you yet? I swear, Marius, soon you won't be able to turn a corner without seeing his face in a painting or carved in marble.
Just because you're too ugly to be immortalized in art doesn't mean that I shouldn't be, grinned Julius, well used to Solomon's friendly barbs. And it's hardly a stable. Mistress Kinska's music is wondrous, and yes, I hope to be the subject of a painting by Serena D'Angelis. Perfection exists in all things, my friends, not just war.
Ego this big, chuckled Solomon, spreading his arms wide, as the Phoenix Gate opened once more and Fulgrim entered, fully armoured and robed in a great cloak of feathers the colour of fire. The effect was magnificent, all conversation around the table ceasing in an instant as the Astartes gazed in awe at their beloved leader. The assembled warriors stood and bowed their heads as the Primarch of the Emperor's Children took his place at the table. As always, Eidolon and Vespasian flanked the Primarch, their armour similarly wreathed in cloaks of feathers. Each carried a staff topped with a small brazier of black iron that burned with a red flame. Though the circular table was, in theory, supposed to do away with rank and position, there was no doubting who the master of this gathering was. Other legions might have a more informal setting for their warrior lodges, but the Emperor's children thrived on tradition and ritual, for in repetition came perfection.
Brothers of the Phoenix, said Fulgrim, in the fire I welcome you.
Bekwa Kinska sat at the wide desk of her stateroom aboard the Pride of the Emperor and stared at the blue world below her through the brass-rimmed viewport. Though the scene was beautiful, she hardly saw it, still fuming over the blank pages of music before her and the rejection of Ostian Delafour. Though the boy was plain and unassuming, with no great physical attributes to recommend him over the lovers she had taken over the years, he was young, and Bekwa craved the adoration of the young above all else. They had such innocence, and to corrupt that with the bitterness of age and experience was one of the few pleasures left to her. Since her earliest years, Bekwa had been able to have any man or woman she desired. Nothing had been beyond her. To be denied something now, when she had the opportunity to achieve the incredible, was supremely frustrating.
Her anger at Ostian's refusal of her advances gnawed at her, and she swore a silent oath that he would pay for such effrontery. No one rejected Bekwa Kinska. She placed her fingertips on her temple and gently circled them in an attempt to ease the headache she could feel building behind her eyes. The smooth, artificial texture of the skin felt cold to her, and she dropped her hands to the desk. Surgical augmentations had kept the worst effects of her age from becoming visible, but although she was still considered beautiful, it was only a matter of time before human artifice would not be able to disguise the ravages of aging. She picked up the quill from the desk, and her hand hovered over the page of musical staves, though each line was infuriatingly blank. She had spread the word that she was to compose a new triumphal symphony for the Lord Fulgrim, but thus far she had not put so much as a single note in the ledger. Being selected to join the Remembrancer Order had been a great, if altogether expected, honour, for who else could compete with Bekwa Kinska's musical talents? It was a natural progression from her time at the Conservatoire de Musique, and the potential for new horizons and new conquests seemed limitless. In truth, the spires of terror had grown stale for Bekwa. The same faces and the same platitudes heaped upon her, now ashen and tasteless after so long. What was new for her on terror now that she had sampled every carnal and narcotic pleasure that her money could buy? What new sensations did a bleak, empty world like terror have to offer a libertine of her Epicurean palate? Perhaps, she had thought, a galaxy reawakening to the manifest destiny of humanity to rule would provide new and undreamed raptures and enchantments. And for a time it had, the newly emergent worlds providing a surfeit of wonders. To be around others of talent had been intoxicating at first, and the music had poured from her fingertips onto the sheet music, as it had before she had won the Argent Mercurio robes for her Symphony of Banished Night. Now the music had stopped, for there was nothing left to inspire her. The world below spun gently on its axis, and she fervently hoped that its beauty would move her to compose once more. Solomon stood as he and his assembled battle brothers rose to answer their Primarch's greeting. As great an honour as it was just to be in the presence of Lord Fulgrim, being included in such rarefied company was another level of pleasure entirely. "We welcome you, our Lord and Master," he said, with the others. Solomon watched as Eidolon and Vespasian moved to either side of Fulgrim and planted their staffs in stirrup cups attached to their chairs before taking their seats. Immediately Solomon could see the tension between the two Lord Commanders and wondered what had passed between them before their arrival. The Brotherhood of the Phoenix was a more exclusive warrior lodge than those within many of the other legions. While the Emperor's children had fought alongside the Lunar Wolves, they had formed great bonds of friendship with the warriors of Horus, and in the times between the fighting, a few loose tongues had spoken of their warrior lodge. The Lunar Wolves' lodge was, in theory, open to any warrior who desired to be a member, an informal place of lively debate where rank held no sway, and a man could speak his mind freely without fear of reprisals. Eventually, Solomon and Marius had been permitted to attend one such meeting, a pleasant evening of honourable camaraderie under the titular leadership of a warrior named Sergar Targost. Solomon had enjoyed the evening, despite the cloak-and-dagger theatrics of their masked arrival, but he could tell that Marius had been uncomfortable with the informality and mingling of ranks. In the traditionally hierarchical core of the Emperor's children, only warriors of rank could join this confraternity. Fulgrim had issued the summons to this meeting of the Brotherhood, and Solomon was intrigued as to what the Primarch had to say. "The cleansing of Laren is almost complete, my brothers," said Fulgrim, and a great cheer went up from the warriors of the Emperor's children. One last Xenos bastion awaits our fury, and I shall lead the attack. For did I not promise that I would plant our standard in the ruins of the Lair's heartland?
You did, cried Marius, and Solomon shared a glance with Julius as they both heard the tone of sycophancy in his words.
Others hammered their fists on the table at the captain of the third's words, and Fulgrim raised a palm to quiet their adulation.
The fighting on Laren has been hard, and we have all lost brothers in arms, said Fulgrim, his tone solemn and redolent with the grief they all felt. But much honour has been won, and when men look back and read what we achieved here, they will believe the chronicler's lie, for surely no legion could conquer an entire race in such a short time. But the Emperor's children are not just any legion. We are the chosen of the Emperor, the only warriors perfect enough to bear his eagle upon their breasts. Each warrior gathered around the table slammed his palm into his breastplate, acknowledging the honour the Emperor had done them, as Fulgrim continued. Your courage and sacrifices have not gone unnoticed, and the colonnade of heroes will forever bear the names and deeds of the dead. I honour their memory in my heart, as will those who come after them. Fulgrim rose from his seat and moved around the table to stand behind the two new warriors. One had the look of the eagle about him, a born warrior with a swaggering expression that Solomon immediately liked, while the other seemed ill at ease with the attention soon to be lavished upon him. Solomon could well understand the warrior's discomfort, remembering his own presentation to the Brotherhood of the Phoenix. Though some die, their deaths allow others to move closer to achieving perfection through war, by taking their place. Welcome them, brothers. Welcome them to your ranks.
The two warriors stood, and Solomon joined with the others in applauding mightily as they bowed to the warrior lodge. Fulgrim placed his hands on the shoulders of the more modest of the pair and said,
This is Captain Saul Tarvitz, a warrior who has fought with great courage on the atolls of Laren. He will be a fine addition to our ranks.
Fulgrim moved to stand behind the cockier of the two.
And this, my brothers, is Lucius, a swordsman of great skill, who embodies what it means to be one of the Emperor's children.
Solomon recognized the names, knowing the warriors by reputation only. He liked the look of Lucius, seeing something of his own wildness in the man. But Tarvitz had what Marius would call the look of a line officer. Tarvitz clearly sensed the scrutiny and inclined his head respectfully in Solomon's direction. He returned the gesture, understanding in a moment that there was no greatness to the warrior and that he would never amount to much. Both Astartes sat back down as Fulgrim circled the table, his cloak of feathers trailing on the smooth floor behind him. Solomon turned to face Marius as he sensed that the Primarch was reluctant to speak. Marius shrugged imperceptibly.
The war below us is almost over, and when we seize the final atoll, it will be time to plan for our next venture into the darkness. I have received word from Ferus Manus that his iron hands are soon to embark on a new crusade, and he requests the honour of our assistance to deal with a most vexing enemy. He is to begin a mass advance into the Lesser Bifold Cluster to engage the enemies of mankind, and this will be a fine chance to demonstrate the principles of perfection upon which our honour rests. We will rendezvous with my brother at the Carolus Star when the destruction of the lair is complete, and assist the 52nd expedition before continuing, as planned, to the Perdus Anomaly.
Solomon felt his heart beat wildly in his chest and found himself cheering along with the rest of his fellows at the thought of once again going into battle alongside the 10th Legion. The brotherhood between Ferus Manus and Fulgrim was legendary, their friendship closer than any of the other Primarchs, even that of Fulgrim and the War Master, a brother he had fought alongside for decades.
Now tell them the rest,
said a bitter voice from the other side of the table, and Solomon was shocked, rigid, that anyone would dare use such a tone to address the Primarch. Angry stares were directed at the speaker until they realized that it was Lord Commander Eidolon that had spoken.
"Thank you, Eidolon," said Fulgrim, and Solomon could see that he was struggling to hold his temper in check at such a breach of protocol. "I was just getting to that."
An unsettled mood descended upon the gathering, Eidolon's uncharacteristic outburst putting everyone off balance. Solomon felt an odd sensation in his gut, not knowing what it was, but not liking it one bit. Fulgrim returned to his seat and said,
"Unfortunately, not all of us will take part in this campaign, for there are demands of conquest we must obey. The galaxy does not remain compliant without effort and determination, and the War Master has decreed that a portion of our strength must be employed in ensuring that those territories already won do not slip from our grasp through inattention."
Cries of disappointment and denial raced around the table, and Solomon felt his chest tighten at the possibility of not fighting alongside two of the greatest warriors of the age.
"Lord Eidolon will take a company-sized force aboard the Proudheart to the Sata-Lanxus Belt, where he will ensure that the Imperial Governors are maintaining the lawful rule of the Emperor. Captains Lucius and Tarvitz, you will ready your men for immediate transit to the Proudheart. This will be your first action as members of the Brotherhood of the Phoenix, so I expect nothing less than perfection from you both. I know you will not disappoint me."
Both the newly elevated warriors saluted, and though Solomon could see their regret at being denied the chance to travel with the rest of the Legion, Fulgrim's faith in them filled their hearts with joy. Solomon saw that no such joy filled Eidolon's heart, and knew that the Lord Commander must feel shame at his exclusion, though to honour the War Master's command, the force had to be led by a commander of such stature. While Vespasian commanded the forces at Laren, there was no other choice. He realized that Eidolon must know this, but the knowledge would have been no comfort to Solomon had he been in the Lord Commander's position.
"We will sing songs of your bravery upon your return, but for now let us drink and feast to the doom of the lair," said Fulgrim.
The Phoenix Gate was flung open as servants and menials entered, bringing platters of hot meat and case after case of victory wine.
"We shall toast the victory to come," shouted Fulgrim.